Dakota has turned up the frequency. Buses are running more often across Central Ohio. Starting this September, you'll see expanded weekend service on the east and north sides, including the Easton and Polaris corridors. Plus, there are added weekday trips downtown from New Albany, Canal, Winchester, and Tuttle. It's more service, more connections, and more ways to move across the city. Discover the enhanced schedule at coda.com/service changes. That's coda.com/service changes.
There's still time to get holiday ready. Right Rug Flooring makes it easy with next day installation and 24-month special financing with approved credit. Carpet, hardwood, luxury vinyl, and tile. We have everything you need to make your home shine for family and friends this season. Schedule a free in-home estimate or find a showroom near you. Visit rightrug.com. RITERUG.com. Be holiday ready with Right Rug Flooring.
Right here, right now.
Okay, so where would you go after? What would you talk about after?
So I think I think we can't really reckon with this topic without actually perhaps discussing like a little bit of the Arab Wars, because the Sassanids, unlike the Romans, actually do score I think two victories over the Arabs. Battle of the Bridge, which was one. I can't remember the second one, but the Arabs have this way of just prevailing with almost every encounter. And even though the Iranians, you might say, are more conditioned to fight in this climate than what even like the Greeks and Romans are, you know, the Arabs are far more familiar with desert fighting. They're far more familiar with, you know, riding through harsh, you know, desert climates and water scarcity. And I mean, there's even an anecdote where Khalid ibn al-Walid, who's you know, even if you have like the discussion of like the greatest generals in world history, like he would have to be in the top five.
He's on the list, yeah.
He's definitely on the list. Yeah. I mean, at the very least, the top 10. And like he doesn't lose a battle, and he's, you know, like I said, but the Arabs are a bit opportunistic, but I mean, that still doesn't discount their prowess and their skill. I think it's after one of the battles with the Persians, knowing that the Romans have amassed this fairly large army for the Battle of Yarmouk, which is 636. He actually sends a contingent of the Persian army, or you know, the Arab army in Persia, across the desert, across the what the Arabs call Al Jazira, you know, across Mesopotamia, and he basically like doubles the size of the camel contingent and just has the camels drink a heap of water.
Yeah.
And using navigation through the stars, completely bypasses all the Roman border forts through a way that the Romans think is impossible to invade, and then pops up somewhere in like southern what they call Coeol Syria. And has his men just, you know, intermittently kill the camels to take the water out of the hump. And they actually make it across the desert with very few losses.
Mm.
And the Romans are like, wow, there's like 10,000 more men here. Holy moly. Like, you know, we're in trouble now.
That's the classic Arab thing, Bedouin thing of, we can take a camel mounted army where you just cannot even comprehend that we could do that, that men can do that.
You know,
and then they do it. And it's like, well, all right, you got us. You got us. We're not ready. We're not prepared from that angle.
And I mean, the Romans had varying degrees of success in that part of the world. But you look, for example, you know, the Crassus and the disaster at Carrhae, or even Mark Antony in his Parthian expedition. Like, when you're not prepared, the attrition you can suffer is immense.
They do it all the way up to killing the Ottomans in World War One.
Yeah.
Lawrence of Arabia leading
camel
armies against the Ottomans in 1917.
Bedouin insurgents, you know? On camel back.
So they were doing that in late antiquity.
Absolutely, yeah.
And all the way through the Middle Ages.
So to their credit, the Sassanids do fight very gallantly. And for instance, once they start losing cities in Mesopotamia, they do fortify.
Like modern day Syria and Iraq, we talk about. Basically.
Well, in this case, modern day Iraq, right? You know, basically a stretch from what it would be modern day Basra to Mosul, right? You know, and the Arabs capture city by city by city by city. And eventually they reach, well, in this time it's called Seleucia, but Ctesiphon Seleucia. It's basically modern-day Baghdad.
Mm-hmm.
And after a very bitter siege, the Arabs do take it. After certain Persian elements defect to the Arabs, Khosrow evacuates the city, and they do make a couple of stands in and around like the Zagros Mountains. I think the final battle is the Battle of Navahund, I think it's called. But really, after that point, the treasury is expended. And because, I mean, all this in the aftermath too, that after the loss of the final war with Heraclius, Khosrow is deposed and killed. And then you just have this massive succession crisis. They do settle on a general, Rostam, pardon my Iranian if it's bad, but I think it's Farrukhzad is a general who basically becomes like
a king regent.
I won't
even attempt it. Yeah.
I simply try. Because in the end, like, you know, I mean, I think it's due the credit that Iran gets, because I mean, Persia is a great civilization. Certainly in the pre-modern time, Persia was a great civilization. And they're people with a longer history than my own, for instance. And Rostam actually almost fights the Arabs to a standstill, but then he's actually killed in battle. He's thrown from his elephant and crushed. And, you know, it's one of those tight run sort of situations where the Arabs just pit the civilized army. But really, from the loss of Ctesiphon, and then afterwards the loss of the Battle of Navahund, which was the last rallying of the Persian armies, the state more or less collapses. And in a bit of a parallel to the fate of Darius with Bessus, they flee east, and the last king is killed in an underhanded way. Like, for instance, in this case, I can't remember what if it's like Shapur the Third or whichever one is the last emperor or the last king of Persia. He's killed by Mila on the outskirts of Merv.
All right.
You know, so it's a very similar fate to Darius.
Anyways. Hunted down to the ends of the earth.
Almost. But that being said, is that his? I believe one of his relatives, I can't remember if it's like a cousin or a son or something, actually survives in the Chinese court. Because the Chinese actually have designs to re-establish the Sassanids, you know, in the Fagani plains, but just never materializes. So Persia's wiped off the map. And although there is a struggle, for instance, as an example's sake, the Bavandid dynasty, which existed just sort of south of the Caspian Sea, fight on and the Yustanids. There's a few, you know, families that maintain their Zoroastrian religion, their Persian identity, and actually sort of fight for another couple of centuries in the mountainous regions of Gilan and sort of southern Azerbaijan, what is sort of today, actually not far from modern day Tehran, the Alborz Mountains. But the Arabs are just very powerful, and they proselytize with great energy, and Persia, you might say, is never the same again.
So this is when the quote-unquote Middle East becomes Islamic.
More or less.
Is this.
And then inversely, you have the Romans have some initial success against the Arabs, in terms of the border skirmishes, but once the Arabs start pouring comprehensive forces into Syria, for instance, the Romans lose Damascus, I think, in 632. But even then, the siege of Damascus is like a six-month affair. And its general, Thomas, is fighting with one eye missing, and the city only falls when an Arab defector converts and opens the gates for the Arabs to take the city.
Right.
But, you know, the Romans send a counterattack to Damascus and almost retake it. But Heraclius at this point realizes that it's not just a border incursion, and hearing reports from the Persians, because at this point the Romans and the Persians are cooperating, he realizes that this is actually a major, major problem. Mm. So he's pulling troops from all across the border, raising new soldiers, and dispatches this army to a place called Yarmouk, which is a river in modern day. It's sort of not far from the Litani. It's sort of one of those parts of the world that sort of separates, like, what do you call Lebanon from, you know, Judea, Palestine, that part of the world. Mm-hmm. And Yarmouk ends up being almost like a cataclysmic six-day battle, like an absolute struggle. Mm. For instance, even in sort of Arab history, I think it's the second or third battle, they call it the Day of the Eyes, because the Romans used so many archers that so many Arab soldiers at least lost one eye. Like, it was a pretty hard-fought battle, if you get what I mean.
Right.
But, you know, the Romans had Armenian contingents, they had Slavic contingents, they had, you know, in reference to Magna Graecia, like, you know, Roman contingents, a Greek contingent. You know, it was really like them summoning the absolute strength of what they could, given the aftermath they found themselves in after the Persian War. You know, you're talking probably a force of at least 50,000-60,000.
You know, if ancient battles ever go beyond one day, it's a big affair.
Yeah.
It's a very serious affair.
Yeah, I mean,
so for it to go into multiple days.
Well, you got to think that 6 days is almost a week.
Well, you know? Yeah, it's sort of incredible. Even Napoleonic era battles were seldom more than one day.
Yeah, yeah.
If it was a 2 or 3 day thing, it was gigantic. So
yeah, yeah.
You can only infer that this was, well, it was one of those very, very, very pivotal battles that, again, I think a lot of people in the West, in the Western tradition, may never even have heard of.
Which is actually a pity. Say that we shouldn't, you know, keep in mind, say, like Richard the Lionheart, or that we shouldn't keep in mind the capture of Jerusalem in 1099, or, you know, other battles that are more at the, you know, the forefront of our consciousness. You know, for instance, like a lot of people who aren't even particularly fond of history will sort of know of, you know, Alexander. You know, they might not know the Battle of Gaugamela, but they know about Alexander's victories, or they'll know about like Caesar, and they might not know about Pharsalus or whatever, but you know, they'll have some kind of conception. Mm. But Yarmouk just doesn't exist in our sociocultural memory.
Well, and I've never heard of it until I have studied,
as we all do,
Eastern Roman history.
Yeah, yeah, and it's one of the most pivotal battles in the actual entirety of our civilization. It is actually up there in importance with Marathon. It is up there with Thermopylae. It's up there with Pharsalus. It's up there with Milvian Bridge. It determines a lot.
Yeah, a great deal.
Yeah.
Oh, it sets the tone for, well, until today, you could argue, could quite well argue.
We are still living in the reverberations of Yarmouk in many ways. Like, you got to think, if the whole Roman, Persian, Arab conflict had gone differently, there would probably still be a delineation between a larger, more powerful Persian civilization with its own sphere and a Greco-Hellenic Orthodox sphere.
But Turkey would be Christian to this day.
And Syria and Palestine. If you have in your head a map of, say, Justinian pre the Reconquest Wars, that's kind of what an Eastern Empire would look like, centered around Constantinople, if things had gone differently. It didn't, but I'm just making the point that has a massive transformational sort of, you know,
right,
effect.
Yeah.
Yeah. So Yarmouk ends up being quite a disaster. On the sixth day, the Arabs score an absolutely fantastic victory. And much of the Roman army is driven off the field, and much of that was killed. And even within the battle itself, even though the Arabs suffer pretty horrendous losses, out of a force of, say, you know, things estimates sort of very wildly, as you know, with these kind of battles. Mm-hmm. Some say as low as 30, some say as much as 80. I probably settle on somewhere around 50 or 60. Because, I mean, it can be said that a lot of contingents were brought there. So about 2/3 to 3/4 of the army is destroyed. And the Romans retreat to their cities. And one by one, the Arabs capture. They take, you know, they take Jerusalem. Mm-hmm. They take Caesarea Maritima. They take Emesa, and they take all these cities through that, the Levant, and really the East Romans only stabilize things along the Taurus Mountains, and that's where it stays for a couple of centuries.
So they're getting Aleppo, they're getting Damascus.
Homs, Aleppo, Damascus, the whole shebang, yeah. Tartus, Acre, Tyre, the whole shebang. I mean, it is a gradual process. I mean, they didn't take them instantaneously. Like, for instance, the siege of Caesarea Maritima, which is, you know, Caesarea in what is one day Israel, took the Arabs over a year. You know, Gaza, the city of Gaza took several months. And actually there's a story, I think it's of the 40 martyrs of Gaza. So you sort of see some of the emergence, not this is a religious discussion, but you sort of start to see the emergence of like these martyr stories in the late classical, early medieval period as a result of these battles and these losses against the Arabs.
Yeah. So that changes the dynamics. Sort of the world pre-Heraclius is quite different to the world post-Heraclius, right? It's a different map. In the East, anyway.
East. And I think it's fair to say that if it isn't a single hinge point, then somewhere in between or bookended by Justinian and Heraclius is... Before this is the classical world. Even if Rome's fallen, it's still the classical world. But after, it is certainly not the classical world.
Right,
okay. It is a new era, a new world in the true sense of the word.
Or like late antiquity, they like to say now.
Mm.
Which
is a perfectly accurate
description. Yeah, that's reasonable.
Late antiquity, you could more or less say that late antiquity dies on the battlefield of Yarmouk.
Yeah, right, fair enough. Yeah. And I know historians love to draw essentially arbitrary lines in the sand, although, but they're not arbitrary often. They're actually not arbitrary. It does make complete sense to do that. It does make sense. It's not just so it makes a textbook easier to cut up into chapters. It really is a real thing. It really it really was pivotal.
There are events that do delineate and, you know, forever transform time after.
Things do happen.
After the event.
You're saying things do happen.
Absolutely. Yeah, 100%. Yeah, of course. And of things, course. even after the fall of Yarmouk, even though the Romans are in, you know, perpetual retreat at this point, you know, and I've only sort of had a bit of a cursory look at this. I mean, I'm more well read about other things as well, but you know, the Arab conquest of Egypt was not an easy thing. Between the Romans holding on to Alexandria and then fighting on to the what you could call the Nile capital, or it was a fortress called Heliopolis, of which is several Heliopolises in the ancient world, but the one along the Nile, I mean, again, it takes the Arabs almost a year to capture it. You know, even Alexandria wasn't a simple thing. And even actually after the loss of Alexandria, it's one of the few instances where I believe Heraclius might still have been alive, but he dispatches a naval task force to recapture Alexandria. And they actually push into the delta and like actually start retaking parts of Egypt until they're contained and defeated at Battle of Nikkiu, which is, I think, in the 640s at some point. But you know, the Arabs just have this irresistible momentum, and sort of every year or two, the if I could call it the government, you know, of the caliphate based in Mecca, sends just continual streams of reinforcements to all these generals who are sort of fighting on the periphery, expanding the Rashidun caliphate both west along Africa, placing a lot of pressure under the Byzantines northwards, and then they eventually come into conflict with the Armenians and later the Khazars. And then they're marching eastwards. They've completely overrun Persia. They're at the Indus Valley. They're pushing into Khorasan and what you'd call the, you know, Ferganian Valley. They fight a battle against the Chinese. I mean, they accomplished that within two generations. It's actually quite astonishing.
Yeah. If you look at maybe a time lapse, you can get, you find sort of maps, can't you, where it's a time lapse of
YouTube,
how different empires grow and shrink. Yeah, the Arab one, to begin with, just boom.
Yeah, yeah.
Just a massive explosion.
Yeah, absolutely.
Crazy. Okay, so this impacts Byzantium.
Hugely,
but of course,
hugely.
So they race along North Africa. They race out in eastwards across.
I will say that, like I said about Egypt, in that it was hard fought over. So was Carthage, actually, because again, the Carthage presents another instance where they counterattack from Sicily with a naval task force. And actually, funnily enough, the Visigoths actually assist the Byzantines as well. And that's actually where the Arabs reckon with destroying Carthage. And that's where they found the modern city of Tunis. You know, and then, you know, if we want to touch on, we can. But, you know, then they get to, you know, Morocco, Algeria. They cross the Straits of Gibraltar. And then, I mean, even in sort of, shall we say, more vanilla or slightly, you know, more... I think our more sort of mild compatriots in the political sphere will often know about Tours Portier and, right, you know, the Charles
that's
Martel.
Like, what, the 8th century, isn't it? That's the 7...
Yeah.
Yeah.
I can't remember the exact date of Battle of Tours Portier, but yeah, it's Charles Martel.
Yeah.
And then, you know, there's this whole thing about, oh, well, the Arabs were here and the Franks defeated them. It's like, there's this whole backstory of how they actually got that bloody far.
Right, yeah.
You know, you got to think, to get from Alexandria the long way around to Aquitaine, to southern France, it takes some doing, you know. And you're talking also the complete destruction of Visigothic Spain, essentially. They hold a small, tiny sliver kingdom in the north, what they call Asturias. Yeah, and I mean, the Arabs, like I said, they accomplished that in a couple of generations.
To draw it back to Byzantium, I'll get on the map.
Yeah.
If they go straight north from Arabia, from the Hejaz, straight north up through... Gaza, modern Jerusalem, modern-day Israel, Lebanon, that direction, they do come up against Byzantium.
Yeah, and the Taurus Mountains, yeah.
And, well, we all know, they don't take it until 1453. It takes them that long.
Yeah, and it's not even the Arabs.
And it's not even the true Arabs at that point, right? But so that's really where Byzantium comes into its own, really. It is a rock against which the Arab armies crash against.
It becomes, you might say, recognisably the medieval entity which is still technically the East Roman Empire, but we, what we call was Byzantium. And I mean, I would gladly and do call it the East Roman Empire, but for sake of historical reference, you know, Byzantium is easier for a lot of people. And so this is the Byzantine Empire that's centered around Constantinople. Its army's transformed, its demography's transformed, also in terms of its internal politics. And this is actually an interesting little sort of side point. The Arabs had quite an easy time once East Roman armies were defeated in the field, or when their, you know, troops were sort of attritioned in the cities, you know, during sieges. Many Christians in the East actually opened the doors to the Arabs because of the sort of monophysite-miphysite split, the nature of God. You know, I can't remember exactly what, you'll have to ask Apostolic Majesty, he's more into theology than I am.
Are you talking about the Great Schism?
No, not the Great Schism.
Oh,
no,
so this
is like interpretation between like the nature of God, whether it's he's
an inter-Christian
schism, but within like the Eastern Church specifically.
Oh, okay.
So the idea is that, you know, is God, you know, like for example, when you sort of say prayer, say Father, Son, Holy Spirit, you know, it's like, does God have three natures, or is he sort of three natures in one,
right?
God, right? It's a
like the Arian, not the Arian controversy.
But in a similar vein, right?
Okay.
Well, like for instance, you know, like Armenians are mostly, Coptics are mostly Miphysite, and then Greeks are mostly Monophysite.
Sorry, okay, I know what you're talking about.
So that split happens, and it's sort of the line between Greeks and Armenians and Christian Arabs and Copts, and it ends up being quite, well, for instance, it to some degree weakened Justinian, even, and to some degree kind of crippled Mauritius as well.
So I was gonna say that goes back to the 5th century, isn't it?
Yeah, it's like in the aftermath of Arcadius, more or less. Like,
yeah,
that's how far back it goes.
Okay.
And so a lot of these Christians that don't adhere to the policy of the patriarch, which is Monophysism, you know, the Monophysites, go, well, if we're going to get punished by Constantinople, then, oh well, how bad is the jizya? You know, we'll be able to practice, you know, unimpeded. And in a lot of cases, they do actually cooperate with the Arabs and just pay the jizya. And also too, at this point, because of all the catastrophes that occurred in Byzantium, there started to come, as was under Justinian's time, a very heavy tax regime, and the jizya was a flat tax. So for a lot of people, it actually made sense to welcome the Arabs.
And the true Arab, those earlier invasions are, I think it's fair to say that their rule is, not as bad, let's say, as sort of the later Ottoman rule, which could be extremely oppressive and repressive.
They were very much
again, if you
off.
Pay the jizya, then you can.
They were largely hands off, insofar as, I mean, we know what the stipulation is. It's a rule of three. It's convert, die, or pay the jizya.
Yeah.
But once the jizya was paid, then they were largely hands off, which is something that can't really be said for later, you know, empires, later, you know, Islamic regimes. Certainly the Rashiduns, the Umayyads, and I would say probably was true sort of around Saladin's time with the sort of the Abbasids and the Fatimids. It was fairly kind of hands-off-ish, you know, because you got to think, even until like early modern times, I mean, there have still been very large intact Christian Arab populations in the Near East, which, like you say about historical amnesia, most people in the West don't appreciate, you know. You got to think, like, prior to even the Gulf War, you know, there were 800,000 Arab Christians in Iraq. Like, most people would know that.
Yeah.
You know?
No, it's true. Mm. Something like the Islamic State, or even the post-1979 Iranian Revolution, or even the Wahhabists of Saudi Arabia today, they're actually quite strong.
Highly repressive.
Strong in terms of their repression. Even in medieval times, often an Islamic regime wouldn't be that
quite
authoritarian.
Quite literally.
Like, and ISIS is way more authoritarian than most medieval Islamic states.
Well, this is the irony. And I mean, I know this isn't about the Arabs, but this is a slight tangent for the sake of curiosity and for our viewers' sake, is that in a very literal sense, the initial Rashidun caliphate of Muhammad's successors, you know, Abu Bakr and so on, were more lenient to jizya payers than the current regime in Saudi Arabia. Like, literal food for thought. You know, that it's the same territory. It's still, I mean, I know the capital is Riyadh nowadays, but, you know, Mecca, Medina exists within that country, and it's the center of Islam, or rather, you know, it's like the holy center point of Islam. But, you know, the and I'm not here to like argue about Islamic tolerance necessarily. I'm just giving the perspective of comparing the two eras and the two times. And what was the appeal, for instance, of the Maifazites to actually just say, well, the Romans are gone, the tax regime's gone, I pay the jizya, I can just get on with my life. Mm. I mean, you know, a lot of people like to get pent up about, oh, well, you should just fight to the last man. But I mean, you know, people had lives to live. And also the ancient and medieval world was a rather harsher place than it is today. And, you know, I think people were kind of grateful to get out of a siege with their life, you know, and a piece of bread in their hand, if you get what I mean.
So where would you go then, do you think? Because often when you look at the Byzantine Empire, there's periods where there's someone very, very important and pivotal and interesting, like Heraclius. And then you might get whole dynasties or whole years, decades, or even a century or more, where it's sort of not as interesting, not as pivotal. Mm. Or you get a whole bunch of rulers, a quick succession of them, and they're all... usurping each other, and there's no sort of standout figure necessarily, or there's no sort of truly, truly massively pivotal event. So where would, in your mind, where do you go?
Well, the thing is that you sort of, there's sort of a number of these catastrophes, you know, I mean, we know that, was it under Justinian II where was it someone else where they temporarily relocated the capital to Syracuse in Sicily? And then, like, the court murdered him and then transferred the regime back to Constantinople.
Who was that?
I'm trying to think if that was... I got a feeling it was Justinian II, but I can't actually remember now. I sound like an amateur, I should know.
Doesn't Justinian II get his tongue cut out or his eyes put out?
No, because his nickname was Rhino, like Rhino.
He had his nose cut off, didn't he?
And he had the mask.
Yeah, he had fake nose. Like Tycho Brahe.
But anyway, you know, there's a quite a dark period following the death of Heraclius, which is actually unfortunate because he did have sons, but they were not of stature. You know, put it this way, if Heraclius had a son as he was to his father, the empire would have actually stood a pretty decent chance of, if not throwing the Arabs back, but at the very least holding station. Under a different emperor, for instance, they probably would have held Tunisia and what we call Carthage. They probably wouldn't have lost Sicily, but you know, fate wasn't kind to the empire at this time.
We hope you enjoyed that video, and if you did, please head over to lotuseaters.com for the full unabridged video.
Heard about Moto Casino? Moto has real Vegas slots. Any game you can find on the floor in Vegas, you can play it on Moto. I like my slots hot. Moto's free to play, like food stamps, in line at the grocery store, at a funeral, in traffic. Keep your eyes on the road. Hop on Moto Casino. Moto Casino got jackpots that are bigger than my belly. Moto, America's hottest free-to-play social casino.
Download the Moto Casino app today. Moto Casino is a social casino. Void where prohibited. No purchase necessary. Visit Moto.us for more details.
Moto Casino. America's social casino.
Coda has turned up the frequency. Buses are running more often across Central Ohio. Starting this September, you'll see expanded weekend service on the east and north sides, including the Easton and Polaris corridors. Plus, there are added weekday trips downtown from New Albany, Canal, Winchester, and Tuttle. It's more service, more connections, and more ways to move across the city. Discover the enhanced schedule at coda.com/service changes. That's coda.com/service changes.
There's still time to get holiday ready. Right Rug Flooring makes it easy with next day installation and 24-month special financing with approved credit. Carpet, hardwood, luxury vinyl, and tile. We have everything you need to make your home shine for family and friends this season. Schedule a free in-home estimate or find a showroom near you. Visit rightrug.com. RITERUG.com. Be holiday ready with Right Rug Flooring.
Right here, right now.